Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Michael Crawford. Michael Crawford is a British researcher who focuses on the importance of marine fatty acids in human development and health outcomes. Michael got his PhD in 1960 in chemical pathology at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School, University of London. Since then, Michael has been a vital part of countless projects, including setting up advanced medical schools and hospitals in Uganda, working with the Indonesian government on marine farming projects, all the while becoming the world's expert in essential fatty acids. Michael has a particular interest in the role and necessity of docosahexaenoic acid, the omega-3 fatty acid DHA, and arachidonic acid in the evolution of the brain. Humans have the largest brain relative to body size, and our brains are made predominantly of highly unsaturated fatty acids, particularly DHA. Without the consistent consumption of seafood during our early evolution, as we left the trees and departed our primate ancestors, we could have never developed the cranial capacity we eventually did without DHA and seafood consumption. However, with shifting dietary patterns and destruction of marine habitats, the all-critical marine food web is being damaged. Michael posits that this will spell disaster for humanity if we do not maintain a strong relationship with these essential marine nutrients. Michael's new book, The Shrinking Brain, documents how our brains developed, what has gone wrong over the last century, and what we can do to optimally nourish ourselves and our progeny. He also has several recent publications regarding the quantum mechanical effects of DHA in signal transduction in the brain. With all this being said, I really hope you enjoy the episode. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me, Michael. This is a huge privilege for me because I've been following your work, I guess, a little bit more peripherally in the past, but much more recently since I've got your book.
Okay. And,
you know, you published a paper relatively recently that I found quite fascinating as well. So thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me.
Yeah, right. That's the entropy paper, I presume you're talking about.
Yes, I've got it here with me. I'm not sure I'm intelligent enough to understand it completely, but there are certainly some things that really piqued my interest for sure. And this carries on from some of your previous work as well that I'd read that also went over my head a little bit. But maybe we can start at the beginning, which is, you know, how did you start to get interested in essential fatty acids and their role in human nutrition in the first place?
Well, that's a long story. It dates back to Africa when I was teaching at Makerere College Medical School in Kampala, Uganda. And the idea was that the British government had just given Uganda a brilliant new teaching hospital. And they were sending people out to the UK, from the UK, to help with the establishment and to reinsure the greatness of the, what a great medical school, actually, one of the first in Africa. It was linked with University of London, so they were sure of the quality, etc., etc. Anyway, so working in Africa for 5 years, as I did, I became acutely aware of the significance of nutrition. I hadn't really realized just how important nutrition was until I went to Africa. And there was something striking that we had meetings with gorillas and chimpanzees and all sorts of things. And the odd thing was, why did all these different animals have different sizes of brains? That struck me when I was working doing comparative studies in Uganda. And so when I returned to the UK, I was invited to set up a laboratory at the Nuffield Institute of Comparative Medicine at the time, and a biochemistry laboratory. And so I had to ask myself, and the people that I was chosen to employ at the time, you know, what are we going to do? And this, you know, obviously nutrition is terribly important. And it was quite clear that the people at the time were saying dreadful things about fats causing death from heart disease, and rising. And I thought about this business about the brain being different sizes and chimpanzees being really quite lovely little animals, but very small brains. And we're supposed to come from chimpanzees. So how did all that happen? So I thought, well, our priority research ought to be on the brain. And but the brain is made of fat. So we want to do fat research, but we can't do the cardiovascular stuff because everybody's into that. So we'll stick with the brain. That's how it all started. And we did a comparative study to look at the chemistry of the brain from many different species. It ended up being 42, but the original study was 32, 36 or something. And the striking thing was, and it really bowled us over, was that every time we came up with an analysis of the brain, it's the same. Didn't matter what species. But muscle and liver fats were all different. And one could actually see in the data that the difference was due to the sort of genes and the sort of way the animal was designed and what it ate, specifically in what it ate. So the fact that the brain was made with this very tightly conserved profile of fatty acid made us consider that that profile had to be really important. And it was dominated by arachidonic acid and the cosaxylic acid. And this is where it all started. So the rest is history.
Wow, and what year was this? When was all this happening in your life?
This was in the 1970s, and the things I've missed out in that narrative is the fact that the chemistry of the brains was always the same. The difference was the extent to which it had evolved, so size. And that's really where it got us going about the importance of the essential fatty acids in the brain.
Yeah, it's so fascinating that, you know, one of the big differentiating factors between humans and other species is the size of brain relative to the rest of the body. And humans are very similar. We're probably the tippy top, but, you know, dolphins are very close behind as well. But most animals, their brain is relatively small compared to their body, particularly the large herbivorous animals that live predominantly off grass. And I suspect we'll get an understanding as to why their brain stayed that size. But you talk quite a bit in the book about Darwin's conditions of existence. And it's basically saying how the environment shapes the evolution of the organism rather than, you know, this neo-Darwinian or you know what August Weismann came up with, which was just everything was just random mutation and some things stuck and some things didn't. But as you succinctly point out, you know, whether a random mutation makes sense is completely dependent on the environment that it's in the first place. So the environment really is the thing that makes the calls as to whether any changes make sense or not. And clearly it seems absolutely obvious to me that the way our brains grew bigger was an access to DHA, the marine fatty acid that you can only really procure from the marine food web. And for humans to evolve, we had to have been consuming food from the ocean or the marine food web.
Yes, correct. We can include the freshwater stuff as well. But the richest source would have been the estuaries and the coastline, without any question. And the point really being that I think we mentioned in the book that 600 million years ago, when the oxygen level, oxygen tension rose sufficiently for air breathing rights to evolve, everything happened extremely fast, and that was a very, very good example of Darwin's conditions of existence. Air breathing life could not evolve until there was air. and you know, the August Weston's complete stupidity that led to Neo Darwin's is mentioned in the book. But the point really is that in the Vendian and the early Cameron, as the oxygen tension rose, there was no ozone layer. And this is critically important because with the increase of oxygen, opening up the whole panorama of oxidative metabolism or biology and chemical synthesis, because one needs to remember that chemicals in those early days were abundant, ordinary just chemicals and minerals and all that kind of stuff, because the prokaryotes would have been dying in the billions as the oxygen tension rose. And there'd been a huge library of chemistry for nature to work on. And one of the chemicals that she must have produced at this time in significant quantity must have been dicocyanoic acid. Because if you look at the chemistry of dinoflagellates, which are single-cell systems, that have a photospot that can both receive light and photosynthesize. And although we can't go back 600 million years, it's very likely to be representing some of the first life forms that occurred when oxygen arrived. And vision occurred, and vision was the start of the whole business that led to the brain, because it produced electricity. And we know that dicocyanoic cyanuric acid is rich in the chemistry of the dinoflagellate. And not only dicocyanoic cyanuric acid or DHA, but di-DHA. And you find in your retina, my retina, di-DHA. It is fundamental in the visual photoreception system. And it's extraordinary. 600 million years later, we're still using the chemistry that just started in that early period. And I think that almost certainly that DHA was the original chromophore, taking it, because it absorbs in the ultraviolet. It absorbs in the mid-range of the ultraviolet. And it would, in so doing, because there'd been very intense solar radiation at that time without an ozone, it would convert energize its bioelectron. And these would be pushed into the state mode and cause electrical currents going through the system. And electrical currents going through the system would make it wiggle. You know, put your finger in an electrical bare electrical wire, so you get a shock. It makes you really jump. And if you put an electrode across a muscle, it'll twitch. So that would, of course, the systems to move when they were facing the light. And where would they move to? They would move to the surface where the sunlight was coming in. And that would be where all the food was. So that was the beginning of the air-breathing evolution. And that business of, you then get sort of multicellular systems organized. And it would almost certainly have been that this reception of ultraviolet radiation by DHA started the evolution of the nervous system, and hence the evolution of the brain. So that's as far back as it goes, because if you look at the cephalopods, if you look at the fish, you look at the amphibia, look at reptiles, birds, look at the mammals, and you look at the brains of all these animals, or the eyes of all these animals, and it's always the same. It's always the same. Rich in dicocyanoic cyanuric acid. So it's absolutely abundant, it appears to me, that means dicocyanoic cyanuric acid. fundamentally important to the signaling systems of the brain and to the signaling systems of vision.
It's very easy to forget. Yeah, it's very easy to forget that the eyes are just an extension of the brain.
Well, the brain's an extension of the eye.
Well, yes, so, yeah, exactly. It's very easy to forget that because, you know, you can see the eyes and they're on the outside, whereas the brain is nicely nuzzled in inside the skull. But you mentioned, you know, around this 600 million years ago is probably around about when this long polyunsaturated fatty acid first came onto the scene. That's a long, long time for a molecule like that to stick around. And it suggests that it's doing things that no other molecular configuration can do, and nature could not replace it at all. And you make note of this in one of your last papers, that DPA, docosapentaenoic acid, which is very close to DHA, never replaced it once because it cannot do what DHA is doing. And like you said, it's turning photonic energy into electricity, which is absolutely fascinating to think that that's how your eye is working. There's so many threads that I want to pull here, but I want to touch on the fact that you mentioned DHA was probably the original chromophore. And I think typically people don't think of DHA as a chromophore. But you mentioned in the entropy paper that its maximal absorption is 240 nanometers, which is light that we don't get on terrestrial Earth anymore because of our ozone layer. So this speaks to its antiquity. But I do wonder, how has the ozone layer affected the functioning of this now that is it no longer absorbing at 240?
Well, that's the important question, of course, that when there was no ozone layer, the planet would have been tunneled by high energy ultraviolet radiation. DHA absorbs in the ultraviolet, not in the prism. So when the ozone layer started to close, nature would have to find a different answer for visual transduction. And that's vitamin A, retinol, and rhodopsin, and all the rest of it came from the sea. And DHA still is in there. That's what our entropy paper was about. The subsidiary role is still playing in signal transduction.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Might be jumping ahead just a little bit, but I have read evidence about biophotons. It doesn't seem like a very big topic. Not many people are looking into it, but it does seem as though for some reason our bodies emit photons of light that can be detected using photomultiplier tubes. And from what I understand, they are emitted in this UVC range inside the body. Have you heard anything about biophotons?
Yeah, I'm interested, but I've never heard anything about that. That's fascinating. Yeah. Electrons and photons are very similar in many respects, and so it wouldn't surprise me that you have the photoelectric effect, which of course would what we're talking about at the beginning with DHA converting ultraviolet into electricity, and today with our roofs covered in solar converters as well, the same principle. I had not heard about that, but I would not be surprised because the spacing between a photon and a electron is there, but there are some lands that behave in a very similar way.
I asked a friend of mine who's an astrophysicist about biophotons, and he said he doesn't understand how the body could generate a UV photon because it requires so much energy to generate a UV photon. So he says he's not sure how that's possible. He doesn't doubt it, but it seems very interesting because you can see these pictures from photomultiplier tubes where the individual photons are popping out, particularly in certain places like the fingertips and the tongue. It seems very interesting. If we are emitting UVC photons, then perhaps you know, DHA is still interacting with these photons. They're just endogenously produced.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I don't know anything about it. I'll have to look it all up because that's intriguing.
Yeah,
and you have yes.
It would be interesting to figure out if that actually might still be happening, and DHA is
Yes.
still a chromophore in that region.
That would be interesting, yes.
You mentioned before that particularly in the retina we have this dye DHA, and I think what you're referring to is where there are different positions in a backbone of fatty acids where you can have, you know, SN1, SN2, and SN3
Yes.
positions where the fatty acids slot in next to each other. And it seems as though having DHA in SN1 and SN2 next to each other is important for this signal transduction that you were referring to. It's important for that to happen. Am I on the right track with that?
Well, that is the theory, is that that it contributes because the once we get a convert a signal from a photon, from photon energy into something that's usable by the visual system, two DHAs stuck together would be really thermodynamically very, very interesting.
Yeah. And how do we get to a point where our body is incorporating DHA into those positions adequately? Obviously, we need to be consuming DHA-rich foods because we basically cannot generate DHA endogenously. We have to eat it. That's why it's an essential fatty acid. So how are we getting the DHA in the right place from the right source?
Well, just leave that to nature. Just got to eat it.
Yeah, so it just comes down to eating.
It's taken up by cell membranes. If you took a well, or not, people take the wrong meaning, but if you in culture test the ability of cells, even red cell membranes or nerve cells from the brain, they will soak up DHA if they're given the opportunity. In preference to any other relevant fatty acid. And you mentioned the eicosapentaenoic acid. That is really terribly important because, as you're actually saying, it's the molecule a few steps before, it's the final molecule immediately before DHA, final synthesis. And it differs only by one double bond. Just different by only one double bond. So what that means is the six double bond sequence is the important thing that we have in DHA. And it's extraordinary how, as you mentioned, 600 million years, and five double bonds never worked. It's only six double bonds. Mm-hmm. And when you've got two six double bonds together, you can imagine that's going to be really an interesting chemical association for photoreception.
Yeah, I mean it's very interesting. Even just thinking back to the fact that DHA is a chromophore, a UV chromophore. You know, I was taught in biology that, you know, the more unsaturated a fatty acid is, the more prone it is to lipid peroxidation. And now, you know, you're talking about it interacting with UV photons, which is, you know, extremely high energy photons. How does DHA, how is it protected from peroxidation? I mean, it's obviously very important.
This is a really important question. And to be honest with you, we are not 100% sure of the answer to it. The extraordinary thing is that the synapses, the neuron, their signaling systems, and even the mitochondria, the energy-producing structures inside the cell, of the synapses, the neurons, are extremely rich in DHA. And the brain uses more oxygen than any other organ. It's in the adult, it's only 2% of body weight, but it's using 20% of the energy. And a newborn infant, it's as much as 60% of the energy. So you have this molecule, which is fundamental to the signaling, absolutely fundamental to the signaling, but it's in regions of the biology, which is the most, has the most oxidative action.
Yeah.
And this is a conundrum. And, but nature has done two things. One, Nicholas Bazin, New Orleans, has found that DHA produces its own antioxidant, a thing called neuroprotection 1D1. And Nicholas has published a lot about this. And this is very interesting, that it has its own defense mechanism. And secondly, of course, there is all the antioxidant enzymes. You have the selenoproteins, you have the cuprate and zinc cuprate oxidative enzyme systems, the manganese as well. And interestingly, these different methyloenzymes are distributed in different regions of the cell, plasma membrane, the cytosol, the mitochondria, all have different methyloenzymes protecting against peroxidation. So nature's put up a pretty good effort at seeing that this system is the rogue oxygen atoms don't get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating. And, you know, you look at the concentration of these trace minerals in seafood, and they are some of the highest that you can find. So it seems like nature evolved because seafood had that full package together, and you got everything.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so parsimonious. It's so, it makes so much sense.
Oysters and mussels are really stuffed full of these trace elements.
Yeah. I think oysters are probably the, you know, bite for bite, the best source of things like zinc and copper and selenium that you can.
I wouldn't knock mussels. Mussels are actually stuffed full as well. They're pretty well shoulder to shoulder in this respect.
Mm. Yeah, that I want
to.
Yeah. I want to get into the food sources later, but while we touched on Nicholas Bazin's work, I wanted to ask, because I regret not looking into his information a little bit more, but I have read a little bit of his what he puts forward, and I want to talk about this idea of DHA recycling. You know, he talks about this long loop and short loop DHA recycling. When we consume DHA, how long is it staying in the body before it needs to be replaced? You know, is DHA something that we need to be eating on a regular basis, or is it something you can have a lot of in one sitting and then not have, you know, for a period of time before having more?
Well, the answer to that is that any recycling process is not 100% efficient. No recycling process is 100% efficient. So you're always going to lose stuff in the recycling. And therefore, you do need a that's the simple answer. Mm-hmm. We don't know all the quantitative details of it, but the basic principle is that the recycling cannot be 100% efficient, and therefore you need constant supply.
Mm. And you, I mean, the book is called The Shrinking Brain, which paints a pretty clear picture of what's happening when you're completely disengaged from, you know, the food web that made us who we are. Is there evidence that over the space of a lifetime, if you don't eat seafood at all, that your mental function is impacted, your visual acuity is impacted?
Yeah. Well, the experimental evidence is very clear on this, that sufficiency results in poor cognition, poor learning abilities, and visual acuity during the developmental process is affected as well. That's the work of Arlene Birch at the Retina Foundation in Dallas. So there's plenty of evidence on this, and I guess the point really is that you've just got to keep on eating fish and seafood. And if you look at the epidemiology, the Japanese and people in these island nations, which eat a lot of fish and seafood, but the WHO says that the Japanese have the best longevity, least major depression of any industrialized nation. They eat a lot of fish and seafood. It's changing now, of course, but everything's changing, all being Western.
Yeah.
So much to their
We're in a bit of a weird space now where there are a lot of people, you know, I think rightly talking about the potential dangers that come along with eating seafood because of the contamination issues. And I think I know the answer that you're going to give me, that eating seafood is still a net positive for sure. There's no way around it. But as far as the concerns around things like mercury, accumulation of things like that, I presume the answer is going to be, you know, consuming fish that are lower on the food chain, you know, not consuming things that accumulate a lot of those things, and just try and do your best, make the best of a bad situation, I suppose.
Well, there's no bad situation there. This was all trumped up by the FDA in the United States, and we published recently two drawdowns on this. They haven't looked at the scientific evidence. And we published a couple of papers recently. So Phil Spiller was the lead author on them. He was originally himself in the FDA, and he knew just how rubbish the background to them coming up with this mercury nonsense. I mean, it's just so ridiculous, because when you start to think about it, the Japanese ladies have produced the children after eating fish and seafood practically at every meal. They produce the children that have grown up to have the best longevity, the least major depression, the least cardiovascular disease, the least common cancers. Where is the evidence of any harm from eating fish and seafood? It is non-existent. Don't ask me why the FDA came up with this kind of nonsense, but they did a while ago. And Joe Hebron, who was at the time, he was leading a research group at the National Institutes of Health in the United States, joined up with Golding, Gene Golding at the Bristol University, and Jane and her colleagues were doing a study on a really long-term study on developmental attributes of health of children. And they had a study that involved over 14,000 women, pregnant women, where they examined what happened during the pregnancy, and then followed the children up to 8 years of age. And at 8 years of age, the children from the mothers who ate the most fish and seafood during the pregnancy had the best verbal IQ, had the best several motor function, a whole bunch of stuff, and behavioral scores were all better, a straight line function. In relation to the amount of fish and seafood the mother ate during the pregnancy. So they actually say in their paper in The Lancet in 2007, when all this nonsense started, they actually said that following them, and they gave the evidence for this, and it's all published, they actually said that the advisory of the FDA will do harm. And I'm pretty convinced that is the case. I think this is all part of the escalation of mental ill health and basically it has put. I went to a meeting in Hawaii, and there was a lady who gave evidence who said some, you know, that women seeing this advisory in the United States say, well, if this stuff is a neurotoxic, I'm not going to eat any of them. And if you looked at this 2007 paper by Hibble and Jean Gilding and others, you will see that the people who follow the advice of the children with the worst outcomes. And this is tragic. And it really ought to be stopped.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not relevant.
You have a particular, place in this discussion because of your involvement. I believe you started Mother and Child Foundation. So, I mean, we should get into how important nutrition is for the expecting mother, even before she conceives.
Before conception.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think you make a point in the book that something like 70% of the cells of the brain are produced during the pregnancy. So you make the point that you only... So nature only gets one shot to make a brain, and if you miss if you miss that window, the effects are lifelong. And I think this advice to limit seafood, like you said, is having generational effects, lifelong.
There's an abundance of evidence that the brain is formed largely before birth.
Yep.
And the seeds of the brain. In fact, the neurogenesis takes place very early. It's one of the first things that happens. And, by 12 weeks, when a woman comes to us at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, comes to the for comfort pregnancy care, at 12 weeks, the nerve cells that are going to form the cortex are already doing so.
Yeah.
And what our data showed was that the conditions of the mother around about the time of conception and before was really critical to the outcome of pregnancy with regard to this respect. And it's logical. I mean, it's in the Bible, for heaven's sake, you know, seed falling on stony ground and seed falling on the parable of the seeds and things. The ovum is fertilized by a sperm and it attaches itself. This is the seed attaching itself to the mother's womb. And that is the sowing of the seed.
Mm-hmm.
If the environment that it finds itself in is adverse, you're going to get problems with the pregnancy. If the environment is encouraging, this is Darwin's condition of existence again, then it's going to be fine, as it should be. And the trouble is that no government has considered nutrition of the brain as a priority in terms of its food and agricultural policies. It's all about protein. And it's crazy when you stop and think about us in the UK. We're an island nation. We used to be very much dependent on the business.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And, you know, you look at the two things that probably make the biggest difference in, you know, things like IQ and verbal acuity and all of those things that are looked at with regard to brain health, and that's DHA and iodine. And both of them come together in the marine food web. They're really the only place you can get both of those things. And, you know, it just seems like, you know, not consuming fish, you know, during pregnancy and before pregnancy is like trying to smoke cigarettes to prevent Parkinson's disease. You know, it's a really terrible strategy. And, you know, I mean, it sort of brings us to the point about what about things like supplementation with extracted fish oils? What are your thoughts on that? I don't think I've heard you speak about that before.
No, that's a different story, of course, because it's fish oil is dates back a long, long time. In fact, the Romans, if you go to the Museum of London, you'll see amphora in which the Romans were importing fish oil from Spain when they occupied London.
Yep.
So that's how it's, it goes back a long, long time. Yes, it has very positive benefits. I think there's nothing to talk about. During World War II, every pregnant mother had some cod liver oil, orange juice, and milk delivered free of charge to her doorstep, and so on. So, and indeed, during the war, fish and seafood was never rationed. Everything else was, but if you look at a ration book, you'll not find anything about fish and seafood in there. So, historically, we have changed radically in the last half century, and it's all bad news.
For people who aren't particularly keen on eating seafood, and there are more people out there who don't like eating seafood than I would have thought, is supplementation with fish oil a mimic, something that can help?
Yes, I think that there's a fundamental difference between fish oil and eating fish.
Yep.
Fish oil will provide a little DHA and some EPA, which people think is good for health as well. So, but it's full of a lot of other stuff as well, oleic acid and stearic acid, but that's not the problem. The thing is that fish oil is triglycerides. Now, triglyceride is the sort of thing that you find around your waistline. It's body fat.
Yep.
And it is not the structural fat that you use for building the brain, which is phosphoglyceride, not triglyceride. So there's a fundamental difference here between eating fish and seafood, where you get phospholipids, compared to fish oil, which is only the triglyceride.
Right.
The phospholipids, the triglyceride of cod liver oil, contain about 12% EPA and about 8% DHA. Whereas if you look at the cod muscle, that's the fish that you eat, if you look at that, the phosphoglycerides that are in the muscle contain 47% DHA and not much else. So that is the difference between, and it's the phospholipids that are in the brain, not there are very few triglycerides. So there is a whole package with DHA in the phosphoglycerides in fish and seafood, which you don't get with eating cod liver oil or other triglyceride type supplements. So there's a big difference there.
Yeah, that's fascinating. No one ever talks about that structural difference, and I assume that actually would probably make quite a big difference into how it is benefiting the eyes and the brain. Surely the form that it's coming in is just as important as what's coming in. In the first place, that's really fascinating.
Nature loves to have the thing prefabricated, to put it bluntly. We did some studies in the 70s with radioisotopes and looked at, for example, the plant precursor as a source of DHA for the brain, or DHA preformed. And the difference was chalk and cheese, that the preformed DHA was an order of magnitude utilized with greater efficiency than trying to build it out from the parent precursor. You can make it from the parent precursor, but it's a slow process and not a very efficient process at all.
Yeah, I mean, I have firsthand experience with that. There was a period of time a few years ago where I didn't eat any fish, and I checked after some time my fatty acid composition of my red cell membranes, and my alpha linolenic acid was in off the charts, but my DHA was bottom quintile. So
yeah,
the conversion process of the plant omega-3 fatty acids, alpha linolenic acid, is really, really poor at best. And I think it's slightly better in women, which stands to reason, because they need it a bit more than we do. But at the same time, I think it's at most 5%. And even then, you know, you're never going to reach the quantities that you really need by eating.
No, that's true. And I think that Tom Breno in Austin, Texas, has published quite a lot to show that there is a big genetic variation amongst people's ability to do the sentence. But despite that, there is no question to preform is what nature wants all the time.
Yeah, I think even the best converters of the plant forms are still, you know, never ever going to reach their needs. Yeah, yeah. Never going to reach their needs.
But, you know, if you go back a century in the UK, we were very strong on fish, you see. I mean, the bars in the Museum of London, I don't think still got them now, but they did have the notices that were outside the bar, big placards saying oysters free with your beer. The barman in the East End would go down to the Thames and fill their buckets with oysters on the bar so people could walk beer. Now they have crisps soaked in some kind of fat or something like that. So if you get anything free on the bar.
Yeah, I mean, I wish they did that today. I'd probably drink a lot more beer if they did that today.
it was a common food, and salmon was. The apprentices apparently objected to the fact that they were getting too much salmon being fed to them in the factories and things like that. And don't forget that in the first Queen Elizabeth's time, cod really was responsible for about 50% of her income.
Yeah, I mean, cod is such an incredible food.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I think largely the reason that there are people in the northern parts of Scandinavia are, you know, they wouldn't have been able to do it without cod, without that they wouldn't have had any vitamin D to help them assimilate calcium and phosphorus. So cod really allowed the Vikings to set up there, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, they were quite interesting because there was in the museum in Helsinki, there's a whole story about the origin of the Vikings and their relationship with fish and seafood. They were also using seals. They were catching seals, and there's evidence of them an overkill at one time. And they then realized that they had to husband their use of the seal. And after their overkill, they brought seal population back to its original strength and were able to maintain it by managing the resource. We forgot about that kind of stuff. I mean, all we do is grow cows and things.
Yeah, I mean that's one thing that comes through in the book is how important the maintenance and probably the regeneration of our natural environment is if we're going to be able to feed the world enough of these essential nutrients to build a body and build a brain. I think you make a note in the book that as it stands now, we are not catching enough fish to feed everyone the necessary quantities of essential fatty acids from the ocean, so that there are people out there getting, you know, enough, but the vast majority are not getting enough. And, you know, we need to come up with interesting solutions in order to allow everyone to consume enough of these essential nutrients. And I think in your conversation with Sarah Pugh a couple of months ago, you talk about the work that you did in Indonesia with the kelp farmers, which I thought was fascinating because I think sea vegetables are a really underutilized way to farm aquaculture and make money and make us healthy at the same time. Do you think that this is something that should be happening on a bigger scale?
Of course. I mean, it's 10,000 years ago when the people got worried about sourcing food. They started to develop land-based agriculture. They didn't have to do anything about the rivers and the seas because they were so stuffed full of fish and seafood, but they developed land-based agriculture and animal husbandry. Well, now we're facing the same situation now, except it's worse. That is global, and the global population is about 8 billion and will soon be 9 billion. And it's not just going to be a question of whether there currently is not enough DHA to go around with what's being caught. But at the moment, it's a very serious situation because the Boschwright, the government advisory group of 200 international scientists, wrote a report about 10 years ago, or a bit more than that, on the future of agriculture, food and agriculture. And in it, they comment that we've reached the limit of bringing fresh land into arable use. And in fact, the proportion of land-based arable use is diminishing because of increased urbanization. So that's a very similar situation, that really there's a serious problem with getting enough food for the future. And in Africa, in some places, there's millions of children dying from malnutrition, from not enough or the right kind of food, and so on. And as you rightly commented earlier, not just food, but the right kind of food.
Mm.
And to get the right kind of food and to get enough food, never mind the right kind, we're going to have to start farming the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese are doing it now. They have between two islands off Okayama, they have a wonderful organization where, we have grass pastures for cows, sheep, and goats and things like that. And they have marine grass pastures for the fish and seafood.
Mm-hmm.
And they have developed artificial reefs to amplify the food web for the seven different type of species, fish species. So they're designed to amplify the ecology, to give more surface area for the growth of flora. And, for example, one of the species, I can't remember which one, likes to live in holes. And so they have artificial reefs full of holes for this, and they're planted where that particular species does its reproduction and does most of its feeding. So it's a well-worked-out organization for, I call it marine farming, but people call it all sorts of other names, but essentially it is applying the principles of food production on land to food production in the sea.
Yeah,
sort of Jules Verne stuff, but we're going to have to do this. And as an island nation, this country's got huge opportunities, with many islands having been depopulated because of the lack of the fishing.
Mm.
And the history of fishing ports in the UK is very striking, and it's all shrunk. Since 1950, since 2019, which is where we have the data, the per capita landing of fish has shrunk by 40% in the UK.
Yeah.
40%.
So, I mean, I know here in Australia, we have quite a large farmed salmon industry. Down in Tasmania. My understanding of that is that it's really destroying the environment down there and deoxygenating the waters, and the intensity with which they are doing that is really damaging to the environment. There's been a couple of good books written about the destruction that's having. And I've heard a few commentators say that aquaculture or marine farming should come on land, basically in these big tanks where they can be controlled and isolated from the oceans to help them recover. And I think farming things like mussels and oysters on the land in big tanks is actually probably a good way to go, because that way you can control the environment a little bit easier.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I think that there's aquaculture is of course very, very different to what we're talking about in terms of marine farming. And I would have thought that oysters and mussels would have a role to play in this, because they have they clean the water, and they're good food, and they're very simple to farm as well. They don't and I don't see them. In fact, in New Zealand, my daughter lives in New Zealand, so with her family, we visit there quite often. And in the Coromandel, for example, they had a huge amount of mussel farms and things like that. And they turned out to be not just mussel farms, but all people who are fishing people would go to these mussel farms, because a lot of the fish were attracted to the mussel farms,
right?
Because they ate mussels that fell off, and sometimes they would pinch the mussels from the ropes. And on the bottom, you try and catch one of these fish, you let your line go down to the bottom and touch the bottom, but get the bottom feeders. And what we discovered was all our bait was being eaten by crabs. So in fact, this mussel farming was not just a mussel; it was also could be turned into a crab farm, because the crabs were developing big populations due to all the mussels that fell off the ropes. So I think mussels and oyster farming is probably has its uses in the context of marine farming, because it's they do help clean the water. There's no question about that.
Yeah, I want to ask you, this is a little bit of a deviation, but a lot of these papers talk quite heavily in terms of quantum mechanics, which is not classical physics, not what we would usually think about. Was understanding the quantum properties of DHA something that you had to learn much later in your career, or were you aware of quantum physics and the roles that it played with regard to elemental foundational particles earlier on?
Well, I think I was aware of it, but didn't think about it. And it wasn't until relatively recently that we put two and two together and started writing wrote this paper on. But before that, we were. I got into this idea because I was given the prize by the French, and I had to give a lecture. And we get into this thing. So around about 2017, we put forward some of these quantum mechanical ideas that where DHA is involved.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I have read a few things. I mean, there's a line in this entropy paper where you quote. Some other researchers saying that we found that the properties of some of the chromophore vibrations that assist energy transfer during photosynthesis can never be described with classical laws, but this non-classical behavior enhances the efficiency of energy transfer. I mean, it was relatively recently, I think it was only 2007, that it was confirmed that quantum processes could happen in biological systems. And prior to then, it was just assumed that it could never happen because there's too much vibration going on, that it's too warm and it's wet, you know, it's full of water. So these quantum processes could never happen. And now it's becoming obvious that, you know, have a look at something like a mitochondria, where you're dealing with protons and electrons everywhere. Of course, there are going to be quantum things going on. Has this surprised you that, this hasn't been looked at with regard to biological systems as much?
No, I don't think it surprised me. I think it's just that, I mean, science is something that grows, it's growing all the time, and it's testing the borderlines of knowledge. And I think we, in those papers that we quote in the entropy paper, that they make it very clear that a lot of stuff can't be explained by classical physics.
Yeah.
And Penrose has said, in a lot of Sir Roger Penrose in his papers with Hammerfoss, that, you know, we may need a new kind of physics to explain what's going on in the brain.
Mm.
And I think this is true. I think the brain is probably operating on the basis of quantum mechanics, not on the basis of classical physics.
Yeah.
There was this fellow called George Wald got his Nobel Prize for describing all the chemical things that happened after a reception of a photon. And he said in his reception of his prize, Nobel Prize, that the explanation for phototransduction after the initial reception of a photon is too slow to explain the process. It says it's all too slow. All this chemical stuff, proteins moving and ions moving and all that kind of thing, is too slow to explain transduction. And I think the view now is that it is quantum mechanical stuff that's doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're very close together. I mean, we forget about it, but a photon is received by retinol, and rhodopsin is surrounded by DHA. You know, I mean, and it's just a few angstroms away from what's going on. And the idea we're putting forward basically is that these are quantum mechanical processes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the blue light receptors in the retina. I've been told, and I think this is quite, well established now, that those types of cells operate on a Warburg-type metabolism. They use fermentation to produce energy, and it's been difficult for me to wrap my head around why these types of cells operate on that type of metabolism when, you know, I think most people consider that completely just cancer metabolism, when obviously it's being employed for very specific reasons in those types of cells in the retina. So have you heard of this and what's going on there?
I have no idea, quite frankly. And I don't know about it, to be honest with you. But it'll have some rational explanation if we dig down deep enough.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very interesting. I'd love to know why, because nature doesn't make mistakes. It tends to get things right.
No, nature doesn't make mistakes, that's right. Yes. And that's why she kept on using DHA instead of DPA for 600 million years.
Absolutely, yeah. I think I've gotten through a lot of the things that I wanted to ask you about, which is crazy because there were so many things. Just to finish off, I wanted to ask you about the fact that the Japanese tend to consume quite a bit of fish raw. They don't cook it. Do you think that this has any impact on what we're seeing in the epidemiology and why they tend to live longer? Is there a difference between raw and cooked?
Well, not much, but there is a difference. I don't think this is a particularly important difference, but it's true. I mean, I think the principle that I go on is that we touched on this earlier, but the principle I go on is that we started off with a chimpanzee-sized brain of about 340 cc's of cranial capacity. And this rose to 1,700 cc's in the period between 28,000 to 32,000 years ago, which is really, in biological terms, very recent. Now, to do that, to go from 340 to 1,700. You have to have some kind of really strong biological force that develops this direction and increment. You can't build a brain without essential building bricks, and of course DHT was one of the important building bricks. So the only thing that could have done this was the provision of the substrates needed for building the brain. You have to have the substrates that the brain requires. They're universal. All species have the same chemistry, and we know what they are, and you have to get them from the food. Hence, the food system of wild products, I stress the word wild, was the thing that powered brain encephalization from 340 cc's to 1,700 at the top. It shrunk since then, but that's another story. So if we want to know what to eat, the principles of what to eat, for optimum brain, it is wild foods. And fish and seafood are about the only wild foods that are left. But a lot of the stuff that is produced by intensive agriculture or intensive food production no longer has any representation of the wild food system. It's moved very far from it. And I think that's one of the problems that we have today. We need to readdress the food system so that it begins to reflect the kind of power that increased cranial capacity from 340 cc's to 1,700.
Yeah.
Now that's the principle on which I work.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I guess it's sort of not easy to understand that, yeah, that marine food web is really the last wild thing that's left intact. Everything else we eat is has been selectively bred or farmed in a way like chickens are, where they're fed, you know, things that they're not supposed to be eating as well. It's triggered something. I have to ask this question. How does the lipid composition of the cell membranes impact its function? Obviously, now our cell membranes are packed with so much more omega-6 than omega-3 than in our evolutionary past. How is this impacting the function of the cells?
Well, it's very difficult to answer that question, but you can give a quick, short answer. There's a group in Szeged, Hungary, which showed that DHA triggers gene transcription. So there are these signaling systems from the cell membrane that are involved in a two-way conversation and involved with the transcription of certain genes and getting them into action to do certain things. And I think that's about the answer as far as we can get. So there is this relationship. And it's not just DHA, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's in the cell membrane that's involved in signal transduction and involved in the whole process of growth and development.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think that's a great place to finish up and sum up. So I think really the take-home message is, you know, connect back to the marine food web, because you need these essential nutrients that you can only really get there. And you will be doing something good, not only for you, but for the generations to come. And, we could use a bit more brain power on the world, you know, because we've got a lot of problems to sort out. So the more really intelligent and switched on and big-brained people we can have, the better. So
absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned, this is a really important part of that discussion. I thank you so much for all of the work that you've done in this area, because I think I feel like I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, there's just one last parting shot. We really do have to get into the business of farming in the sea. And one aspect of it is that we need to develop, for example, kelp forests. And the beauty about that is that kelp and other forms of seaweed, of course, are both edible, and they provide fertilizer for land use, and they absorb carbon dioxide. So they're actually contributing to the control of ocean acidification and the control of climate change. So actually getting into the whole business of marine agriculture, I think, is the only way forward. And the sooner we start getting serious about it, like the Japanese and some others as well that are starting it, the sooner we start doing it in earnest, and the sooner we start governments thinking about the importance of the brain in terms of their food and agricultural policies, the better it will be for us and our children to come.
Absolutely. Yeah, I hope you're really helping to turn this ship around. I'm optimistic, and hopefully a lot of people are listening to this and making better decisions and driving the people out there who have the capacity to do this stuff to start up the kelp farms and regenerate the oceans so that there more fish can thrive.
That's right.
Mm.
Well done.
Thank you so much for speaking to me. It's been a real honor. I can't thank you enough.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you're interested in reading Michael's work, I've left a few links to his book and some of his papers in the episode notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can subscribe so you can get notified whenever I release a new episode. I'd also like to encourage you to leave a 5-star review or give a thumbs up if you liked the episode. This is a simple, no-cost way to support my work and help me reach more listeners. Please feel free to leave comments on my YouTube channel, as I do try to read through as many as I can. I've also put links to all of my social media platforms in the episode notes if you'd like to just reach out to me in any way, shape, or form. So thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.